Welcome to What the Hex, your source for Warhammer Underworlds in under 30 critical defenses or less. Your host for today is myself, Davey. I got Phil on here. How are you doing, Phil?
Doing all right.
And we have a guest, Michael Carlin. Michael, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, great to be here.
Yeah, thanks for coming in. We're going to give you a quick intro here in a second, but as always, I'd like to say thanks for tuning in. Thanks for listening. Thanks for getting in touch with us. It's been great. We've had some nice engagement on Facebook. I really appreciate talking to people over there. As always, you can get us on Facebook. I'm floating around in the groups and on Discord. Or you can get us on Twitter at WTHcast. Today, we're going to be talking about defensive play, which is also known as control play in the sort of GW-defined terms. And a special shout-out to Jonathan Davis from Path to Glory and Wigglehammer for helping me make sure I'm using terms that are more universal. I thought it was a good point right off the bat. But we're bringing in Michael Carlin. Actually, Michael, we talked to you a while back about the possibility of doing an episode and then finally got back around to doing it. So thanks for your patience here. But Michael Carlin, probably best known for being a member of Steel City and that blog, Steel City Underworlds. I was real excited. I think it felt like a bunch of the blogs dropped, you know, started putting out content at the same time. And I remember I was just totally starved for content. But and I was real glad to see all those come out. One of my favorite things you do on that blog, though, especially is with your articles, you do a really cool breakdown of here's a deck I came up with. Here's why I put each card in. Those have been some of the more interesting reading I've had on any of the blogs out there. And I've returned to a number of them several times. Specifically, I really enjoyed you had a mid-range Magors, which was real interesting. And and you had most recently your breakdown of your Steelhearts deck. I was really excited at that. And I've been trying that out a little bit and having a lot of fun with it. I think I mentioned as much earlier. But let's see. I also want to give you a personal shout out. I watched you were on, you guessed it on Ready for Action. Is that correct? You had
yes.
A little bit in there. Are those fellas still going? I haven't seen anything for a little while. I enjoyed their first couple of outings, but are you in the know on that front?
So me and Tom are pretty good friends with them. Like they're all from Derby, that lot. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason they haven't put out a podcast recently is because they've not all been to a tournament together.
Uh-huh. All right.
It seems their format is they all go together and they all chat about how their decks do and their games do.
Yeah.
But the last one I saw them at was there was this one that John Reese went to as well in Birmingham.
Okay.
And only one of them was there, and I don't think it was quite enough for them to justify doing a podcast off.
I got it.
But they'll be back.
Sure. Good. I'm looking forward to it. I like that format for them. It's not something that anyone else is doing right now, which is always cool. Well, the other thing I want to mention is that you had you were on a video that has only been the one so far as I can tell, and it's a little bit hard to find, but Jamie Giblin on Cataphrane Relic put out a YouTube. It's you playing somebody who's you got your Steel Hearts and he's playing Eyes of the Nine, and I'd recently read your article and went and found that to watch you play. And I wanted to give a little salute. You were both very gentlemanly. It was really awesome to watch a battle report where the level of play was high. It's not often you watch, you know, because everybody makes mistakes. I don't know that I saw any mistakes go by, and that was very cool. And then nobody got bent out of shape about dice. I was like, ah, man, this is very refreshing to see. You're like, oh, well, that's how that goes, I guess. And I don't know. I thought just watching it, I was like, ah, this is an example of the kind of game that everybody hopes to get to play. So I imagine you're really kind of just a terror, and you were just on your best behavior because you knew you were on video. But
oh yeah, I'm awful normally.
that sounds right. But that's enough of me bouncing all over the place. Could you let's do our little bit about what you're doing. Tell us a little bit about what you've been up to, and maybe a little bit about Steel City. What you guys have planned, maybe for the blog, and or what you have been doing on your own lately.
Well, I've got to talk about Steel City first,
okay?
Because it's actually quite relevant to our topic today. So
excellent.
Oh, I don't know if you know about this. A while ago, are you aware of the Relic decks from back in the day?
Sure.
Yes.
That rather controversial period in Warhammer Underworld history. So our group, one of our group, a guy called Dan, whose pen name online is Hobbit, came up with the idea for the Relic decks and then swiftly moved to Australia. So we had no responsibility for it. But my co-author Vanadas and someone else we were with called Lee took that to one of the Warhammer Underworld's Grand Clashes.
Everybody was really happy. I got a bit unfortunate. Yeah. Okay.
Oh, everyone was lovely. I got a bit unfortunate. Round one, I got Face versus Lee. But basically, it destroyed. It was horrifying. Lee, unfortunately, didn't win the whole tournament because he came up against the one other person who'd invented it independent of us. A guy called Sandro. Can't remember his surname.
Okay.
But yeah, basically, Relics happened and the community, there was a big backlash against them. Initially, I wasn't sure it was justified because we didn't know that they were broken. They surprised everyone. But then after the next couple of tournaments, it was obviously justified. They were broken.
Sure.
It was ridiculous. Games Workshop pretty much banned them. Not actually banned them, but made them unviable. And then ever since that experience, there's been a very negative opinion in the community on defensive decks. Just one of the tournaments that Relics won at, I think it was so ridiculous that there was two Relic decks in the final and they ended up having to determine the winner of a Grand Clash by a roll-off because they had identical glory or something.
Oh, no.
Which is, I can kind of understand why people look at this type of thing and go, it's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
But after Relics were banned, defensive play still exists.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of made the blog to somewhat justify its play and kind of say, look, this is how, teach the rest of the community, this is how it works, so you can see how it works. And also to tell people, this is how you beat it. So that was kind of where it came from, because there's a lot of people on social media being very salty about it. And somewhat justifiably, because they'd seen Relics. But yeah, we started the blog to kind of justify ourselves and try and kind of, this sounds horribly patronizing, but educate people on how to beat it and play against it. And then since then, we just kept going, like, chatting about the game, talking about strategy.
Yeah, all right.
Right now, myself, I'm desperately trying to focus on winning one of the two big Grand Clashes next month that we've got in the UK. We've got one at Warhammer Fest.
Okay.
And we've got one at the UK Games Expo, and they're probably both going to have about 100 players. They look like they're both going to be big ones.
Very nice. Excellent.
So I'm on a secret deck that I'm not revealing to anyone and taking to tournaments.
Okay. Are you even revealing the faction, or is that also classified? And that's totally okay if it is.
It's classified for most stuff. Like, there are obviously people have seen it, so I am taking it to tournaments for practice.
Mm-hmm.
So people like John Reese know of its existence.
Mm-hmm.
Don't worry about it. Enough not to broadcast it to everyone. Yeah, sure. It's got a bit of a trick to it.
Okay. All right. All right. If you said it here, then thousands upon thousands of people would hear it immediately. So,
I know.
Yeah. Our far reaching influence. All right. Well, I'll be eagerly looking for the report on that. Tell me, and this is what I really want to know. Tom and his Godsworn, how has that been going? Has he got
he
some
came
glass
so
yet?
Close.
Is this the one so where there close. Were five rounds? He was undefeated in four rounds and then on that fifth fell? Oh, I broke
That's
my heart
exactly
to read that.
That one.
Yeah.
So John put the article out, and basically Tom himself is waiting to win with Godsworn.
Mm-hmm.
And then it kind of almost feels like when you're doing these articles on how to play a warband that you kind of need to win a trophy with them to kind of feel like you've got the credentials to talk about it, you know? Mm.
Definitely didn't stop me, but go ahead.
Well, he's been on them for 4 months now, and he's built a really good deck. Like, he beat John, and John was playing what he's planning on taking to the Grand Clashes.
Yeah.
John was in serious practice mode, not in the trying to win with all the warbands mode.
Sure.
And it's Godsworn into Fastriders. Like, that's not a pleasant matchup.
Yeah, I mean, I feel a little nauseous just thinking about it. So.
Oh. I mean, it was so tight, though. That best of three was insane. So I managed to finish my games really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And I came over to watch. And so game three, in turn three, they both had the same glory. I think it was like 9 glory apiece.
Mm-hmm.
And they both reveal their objective cards. I can't remember what they all were, but basically they were the same three objectives they both revealed. They both scored like 5 glory. Oh, and so gosh, they were tied on glory. And Tom had managed to win on the tiebreaker because in his last activation, he moved someone to an objective token.
Veteran right. move. Very nice.
Ooh, yeah.
I
yeah.
know that pain of forgetting to do that.
Well, I mean, that feels like credentials good. Right there. So get him right in that article.
Yeah. Now, there's his other excuse that he parades to me, which is a legit one, is he's a junior doctor and he's got to do a lot of training for exams and stuff like that. So
fair enough.
I would be very happy for him to write more articles, but you can only prod him so much.
Well, it will be much appreciated when it arrives. And then we won't rush it any more than that. All right. Very cool. Phil, what have you been up to?
I have sort of been doing a little bit of deck building for Underworlds, but nothing super focused right now. Just kind of playing around with eyes and defensive Malogs ideas. Mm-hmm. Haven't really got anything solid yet for either of them. Haven't really played like 2 practice games with the eyes so far and haven't even tried the Malogs yet, so can't sure. say a whole lot about that. And otherwise, I've been just working on stuff for Age of Sigmar, doing a lot of conversions of Reavers at the moment, which has been fun, but it's a lot more time-consuming than I thought it was going to be.
Oh, all right. That's how conversions go. It's fun, but laborious, at least if you do it my crude and not very good way. I've been doing some of the same stuff. I've actually been just enjoying trying other people's decks out. So I already mentioned, Michael, I was trying your Steel Hearts out, enjoying that a whole lot. I really enjoyed sort of the patient sort of waiting for your moment and then teleporting in and getting the strike. I realize I really like that play style a lot. And I think it might have been a little bit when I was playing Far Striders before. I had something similar. The idea of, you know, not you can avoid committing until you're ready to really, really do it. And I guess that's, you know, can go with any play style. But that I enjoyed that quite a bit. And then the other one, and this is a note on just grabbing someone else's deck. I tried out the Adepticon Grand Clash Winners Nighthaunt deck. I'd never played as Nighthaunt and played. Phil and I got a match in. And while I certainly enjoyed it, it was really funny as I was playing through and I was like, man, where is Ready for Action? And then at the end, I looked and I'm like, it's not in here. This guy made a deck without Ready for Action. Good for him. Same with like Hidden Paths and that sort of thing. And so it was fun to see from the inside a deck that had been built very differently to some of my defaults, and I really appreciate both those decks because they're spending their restricted slots in a way that a lot of people aren't, and that I like anytime somebody's looking at the game and questioning some of the core assumptions. So I think that covers what we've been doing. How about we get into this talk about defensive or control play?
I'm ready to defend defensive decks.
All right. Sounds good.
Very nice.
So we've kind of mentioned, but just to, before we get into one particular archetype, we should, the GW defined is aggro, objective, defensive, and then flex. And when instead of defensive, they say control. So aggro, objective, control, and flex. Is that how you generally see it as well, Michael?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, to be honest, I probably should switch to using the term control because it's what they GW prefer to call it. But we were using the term defensive before there was official name for it. And it's just kind of got into our heads. It's kind of like everyone still calls the game Shadespire, even though that's not what it's called.
You know? Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Stephen Van would appreciate that too.
he's right. Yeah. I love it. It's good.
We can totally call it defensive play here. I just want to make sure folks know as on the way in what we're talking about. And before we get too far into this, it may have been you, I think, on our banned and restricted episode. Somebody gave us a comment because we'd mentioned about we'd sounded a little bit down on the defensive or control archetype. And someone said, I think it was you, were drawing a distinction between defensive and non-interactive play. And do you find them that they're two different things, or is that, has your thinking changed at all on that, or is that where you sit with
it? So basically for me, there are times where you could describe a defensive deck as non-interactive, but those times usually only come up if your deck is bad. Mm-hmm. So, such a horrible thing to say, but if you don't take the right tools to deal with defensive decks, which is one of the reasons why we tried to, you know, write about how they work. We don't necessarily want to just beat people automatically. We'd love to see the community get better. Mm-hmm. But if you don't take the right tools to beat them, then you're going to lose. Okay. I mean, to an extent, the same goes for any type of matchup. If you're a control objective deck and you don't take like push cards, or you don't take stuff like Last Chance, mm-hmm. then you're going to lose against other matchups. Mm-hmm. So there are times where it can feel non-interactive. I think it's mostly new players who fall into the trap against them.
Sure.
Who they say, for instance, you've picked Iron Scores Boys, mm-hmm. and you've put all the cards that add damage or give you an extra attack. Maybe you have to roll a 50-50 for it. I think they've got a faction card for that. Mm-hmm. All that type of stuff. And you deploy as far forward as possible. Someone longboards you, hides at the back, and it feels like you're not playing a game versus them. Mm-hmm. And that can definitely feel non-interactive, and it's certainly not necessarily a fun experience for them. But if they'd put Spectral Wings in, if they put Hidden Paths in, if they knew where to attack the defensive decks, if they had a little bit of passive glory so they could get some upgrades on themselves as they were going forwards, then suddenly it is a proper game. It's kind of like this weird cat and mouse game.
Sure.
Where if your cat's a defensive deck, suddenly it falls apart really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely disagree that they're not interactive, but you have to know how to attack them. And it is not always obvious. Like, it's not like control objective decks, it's obvious. You stop them sitting on objective tokens. Mm-hmm. Aggressive decks, it's obvious. You either starve them of glory by not fighting them, or you kill them first.
Yeah.
Whereas defensive decks, it's not necessarily obvious where you attack them.
Well, and I think that brings us to a good point. That the next question was, what role do we feel what role do defensive decks play? Are they good for the game? And I think you've basically said it there. I think what they do is they create this other route. So instead of it being this aggro arms race, it creates this other branching option. And then if everyone has to keep that in mind, then they got to slow down their arms race on the other side and makes them be more balanced. I know that Aaron would agree with me on this. I think that's every time he sees a different deck archetype, he's excited for it because it keeps the game from being one dimensional. I imagine that's, you know, from having read what you've read what you've written, I think you are probably in the same boat over at Steel City.
Yeah, 100% agree with that. Like, from a deck building kind of perspective, from the part of Warhammer Underworlds that's more of a card game. Having another archetype to have to bear in mind and have to play against, or even to build for yourself, gives the game so much more depth.
Absolutely.
From a purely like arena combat thing where you've just got fighters, it's a more of a, you know, personality thing. Do you like it or not? Fair play, you might not. But from a deck building thing, it gives a lot more depth to the game.
Mm-hmm. And I think, again, you talking about the difference between interactive and non-interactive, you know, the possibility of that. I think it becomes much more interactive if you, like you said, if you've built your deck to prepare for it, and if you're familiar with the idea, because then you're looking like, oh, he's positioned this way. If I can disrupt, you know, some of this positioning, so that then the interaction becomes in that part of the game. But if you're not prepared for what to expect, and then with the tools to deal with that, and we'll talk some more about those a little later on. Then, yes, I think it absolutely ends up falling in that non-interactive thing. And like you said, get good, right? I think there's the direct quote.
So, yeah, that's literally what I said. Anyone who can't beat a defensive deck's rubbish.
Yeah, all right. We'll pull that and use that as a drop for later episodes.
Oh, no.
No. All right. So we've got right off the bat a listener question, since we've kind of thrown out our archetypes. We got Max, and he's from over on the Battle for Salvation podcast, and he is asking, in your mind, how viable do you feel defensive play is in the current meta, given that the meta seems geared towards aggro play styles and dice rolling?
It's actually a really tricky question to answer right now. So two expansions ago, I'd have said it's not super viable. Mm-hmm. When the first bar list hit, it really adversely hit defensive decks. I mean, the two types of decks it hits were defensive decks and John Reese's Skaven deck, of which they banned and restricted like over half of it. So Quick Thinker being straight up banned, I mean, everyone was taking Quick Thinker. This is not me saying Quick Thinker should be unbanned, but it obviously affected defensive decks more than anyone else. It was your get out of jail free card if they do get close to you. Mm, right. And Great Concussion as well was really big for defensive decks because in reality, hold objective, like objective token decks, should beat defensive decks, but Great Concussion just completely shuts down a whole turn for them. Again, I'm glad Great Concussion is banned, but it hurts defensive decks. And now we've seen Deathly Fortitude and Sudden Growth restricted. It can be tough. However, there's two kind of new archetypes that I've got on my eye on that look like they're just about viable now with Curse Breakers. So the traditional defensive deck was always Steel Hearts, kind of sit at the back, score enough glory from passive objectives. Like positional ones, like Skirting Danger, Alone in the Darkness, that type of thing. Cursebreakers now have two kind of potential options. One is the Shard Gale, Cry of Thunder kind of get glory from across the map by killing your guys one. And one which I haven't seen anyone do yet. I've seen Jamie kind of experiment with it with Eyes of the Nine and then basically put a line at the end saying, if I did this for Cursebreakers, it would work. Where you run a full, just I'm trying to cast 8 Gambit spells and use my actions to cast spells. And you do stuff like magical, is it Magical Mastery? The 3 glory for playing 6 spells in a turn.
Yep, yep.
Yeah, you do that one. You just sit at the back casting spells and get glory. I'm not sure if either of them are quite good enough, but they're on the cusp and we're about to get more spells and spell objectives. So when those two new expansions hit, I think they're probably going to be legitimate again. So right now, I probably wouldn't recommend defensive play, like pure defensive play, but keep your eye on it because it could be a big thing soon.
What you mentioned about it being not necessarily full on, but having it as part of it, like that's any of these, I mean, Flex exists as an archetype, but salting some of that in is in there. You mentioned a couple of Stormcasts, so the Steel Hearts and the Curse Breakers as some go-to candidates possibly for this style of play. Are there any other warbands that you would consider like this is a prime candidate for defensive play, like it jumps out?
So Fast Riders are potential. But all of the Stormcast Eternals are really good because they're only 3 models and they've got 4 wounds each, which makes each one difficult to kill. Mm-hmm. 3 models means you can hide quite easily because you don't have to use as many starting hexes. Mm-hmm. And they often have inspired conditions that makes them tougher to hit. Mm. Fast Riders probably the worst of the 3 right now for just pure defensive play. Just they don't have as good objectives for it. And they don't have as good power of cards for it. Back a long time ago, I used to play this kind of weird kind of defensive aggro flex with Fast Riders where it's kind of like how I played the Fiendish. It's basically how I like to play. Mm-hmm. Sit back by default, but then when I've powered up, then I go in. So I kind of have a mix of stuff like Alone in the Darkness, Skirt in Danger, but then I also would have stuff like maybe I'd put No Remorse in or Strong Start, something like that, or Advancing Strike. So kind of trying to take the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
But from a pure defensive, I honestly think it's just Curse Breakers or Steel Hearts right now. I think if you just go in that route, the others don't quite do it.
I agree. And I think Phil will agree with me here. I think I was running a pretty similar Forest Riders where it would, you know, where it'd be able to sit back at exactly those objectives and snap up some of that glory before you actually had to interact. Before you actually had to have the battle fully joined.
Right.
At the time, especially with the full bar, they were available for made it more possible. So those are our obvious ones. Do you think there's any dark horse sleeper options for defensive?
I know people. So Jamie Giblin actually experimented with defensive orcs. He took them to a tournament in Sheffield, and he kind of got wrecked. admittedly, it was a best of one tournament, but it was bad enough that he's not really tried them again. I've looked at them, and they've got stuff going for them. Like, it's very easy to inspire them, and you can control the inspire. So, like, literally, you could pick a board of a lethal hex and run over a lethal hex, and there you go. You've got Shining Example fired up. Two very nice, easy objectives. But having an extra model is nasty, because it's another kind of angle for your opponent to get glory off you and attack you. And they just don't, they don't have enough things they score that are special, really. If we see some extra nice things from your fighters being inspired to score, that's possible. But outside of orcs, I'm trying to think if there's anything else. I mean, I know people, I mean, I think Games Workshop themselves claim that Eye of the Nine are a controls playstyle. I don't really see it. I think if I was building an Eye of the Nine deck, I'd do some sort of weird mix between objective and maybe trying to get stuff off tomes. Either the nine or one of those where you've got to throw stuff at the wall to try and make them work, but just hiding at the back isn't going to work. You've got two fighters on two wounds that fall apart like tissue paper.
Very true. My experience with them is that, defensive is very hard with them. Objectives works better. That's what I've been seeing so far. But they're hard no matter what you do. So I'm not, I think they're just a really hard warband.
But here's what I do enjoy, though, is that they're generally agreed to be pretty hard, pretty difficult. But they keep popping. If someone keeps on bringing them up, getting them into the top 10 of big events. So there's people who are championing them and finding a way to, you know, fight through and get some success with them.
I think there's definitely something there. It's just like, has anyone cracked the code yet? And I don't think they have. And I think part of that might be because we don't have all the Nightfall cards yet. I think it's possible that these next two sets might have some stuff that makes them stronger. But we'll see.
Sure. And I think back to Oryx, I think they pop up in the conversation some because that one shield, but some of their in faction cards. If you're a new player and you're looking at them, you say, "Oh, well, somebody somewhere thinks that these guys can play defensive because they have Art's Iron." I think
living
at the end, or the ones that reduce damage to Haka and Basha. There's Unkillable for Kurzag. There's Edbut, which is kind of, I think of as a control card. So
and
there's these cards in there.
Too dumb to die too.
Sure,
right. Take a hit and don't die. You get a glory for it.
So there's these cards in here that signal that somebody somewhere thinks that it's an option for them, and so I think they keep popping. But I think you're right. I think if you're what I like that you hit especially was that fourth fighter. It really just gets pushed so far forward that it'll let somebody get their glory train rolling if they're an aggro deck. So
it's really unintuitive to think that having an extra fighter is a weakness, but it absolutely can be. And for defensive, this case, just another weakness.
So in that, we indirectly, or fairly directly, we answered Adrian's question. He was asking about defensive orcs, so I think we got that one covered. Phil, you were working, I don't know if you want to talk about it, with the Molog defensive. You're working on some for that?
It has yet to be tested, so I have no idea. It's purely on theory, but the idea being that Molog is so big and so hard to kill that if you play him in a defensive manner, the likelihood of him actually going down is almost zero. And I feel like if you just keep all your other fighters near him, it means that if they want to come in for those supposed easy kills, they're going to get clubbed.
It's a four fighter warband, but that fourth fighter, if you consider the fourth one to be Stalag Squig, is not getting forced onto a hex that's way up forward. So
right, that's and he's on two shields. So I mean, although I've seen him die a whole bunch, it's not a guaranteed thing either. So that kind of helps. I think the question would just be how much passive glory can you score with it? And it looks fairly doable with things like Long Strider and Skirting Danger and stuff. So I think I'm going to try it. And I can sort of report back as to how that goes.
Sure.
I've actually got a tip for you with that type of deck.
Sure.
Try putting Tomb of Glories in.
Oh yeah.
Oh sure. Yeah.
Moloch can use it twice in a turn.
Oh, spicy.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, so there's some of the war bands we were talking about as being options. Let's talk a little about let's talk a little bit about deck construction here. So, Max again from Battle for Salvation, he's asking, what restricted cards do you consider as must-haves if playing a defensive style or control style? Are there some that you say if I'm building control, I'm going back to the well for these particular cards?
For defensive decks, I'd always take Ready for Action pretty much every deck, just because it's the best power card. I mean, weirdly, sometimes if I were to build a pure defensive deck, Ready for Action actually might be close to not being taken because they're one of the very few times where the extra attack isn't that useful. But just a free out of you know sequence move is incredible.
Absolutely,
still take it for that. With regards to other ones, I'd always take Superior Tactician. It's a very easy 3-glory at the end of the game. Alone in the Darkness, if you're going for like the Steel Hearts route, where you're using like say Distraction and Peal of Thunder, so you've got kind of the way to make sure Alone in the Darkness gets scored. Maybe Change of Tactics. It depends. That's more a Cursebreaker special because they've got the Storm Sour's range, so it's quite easy to score. Trying to think of other ones. Escalation's a tricky one. If you're running Spores of Battle, probably almost always yes. If you're not running Spores of Battle, with a defensive deck, Escalation is not always a given because part of your plan is to starve your opponent of glory. And if you're one who's having to always score Escalation, that's actually not that reliable.
Definitely.
Let me diverge for a second here because that's something that I thought about but hadn't jotted any notes down on. You mentioned there, we've talked a lot about how strong we think Glory Denial is. Do you think when you're playing Control, is that the core strength of Control decks? Is Glory Denial? Would you feel
100% agree? Yeah, that's generally that's why it's strong. Is especially against aggressive decks, you just stop them from being able to play their game. And I mean, with Warhammer Underworlds, Glory isn't just your win condition. It's also how you access half your power cards. It's a really, really powerful thing if you can just stop people getting any glory.
Absolutely. I mean, in a game that snowballs like this one can, stopping the snowball from forming in the first place is very powerful.
Do you feel that... So I know you mentioned using Great Concussion as a denial for objective play, but do you feel that trying to deny glory to objectives... decks is harder now than it used to be, or just in general when you're playing defensively?
Yeah, no, it really is. So you either need to be running a lot of push cards like Distraction, or you need to be running like that Cursebreaker thing where you can kill things on objectives. So you can take Shard Gale, Cry of Thunder, and Lethal Ward exists as well.
Yeah.
And Encroaching Shadow for ones that are on edge hexes.
Very good.
Sometimes speaking, this is a bit weird, but sometimes speaking, even if you're running those decks, that's a pure defensive deck. If you're against an objective token deck, you actually need to kind of go in. Like just pop a charge off a Stormsire towards the end and just knock someone off an objective with his ranged attack. And then if they've got sidestep, they use sidestep, then you use distraction. Like it's just an extra way of kind of stopping them. Because if you both sit at the back, they will score more glory than you.
Right, and that's back to our discussion about is the control/defensive archetype, is it good for the game? Yeah, because you get this cool cycle of the matchup of control versus objectives and the matchup of defensive versus aggro and all those looping around how those archetypes interact with each other is a real fun puzzle to look at.
Yeah, almost like go ahead.
I was going to say almost like this soft rock, paper, scissors thing.
Oh, that's exactly what I was going to say.
Oh, sorry.
I kind of wonder, do you think as the community accepts defensive play, would it force a more even distribution of types of decks because there is this sort of counter mechanic of like defensive is pretty good against aggro, but has a harder time against objectives. So people would then bring objectives to play against the defensive decks, but then they're going to have a harder time against aggro. And it would sort of naturally balance, maybe?
I think if this was, if the player base for Warhammer Underworlds was similar, more similar to, say, Magic, then yes. Because people would basically always be trying to take what they think kind of fits the meta and what they think is going to win. But with the fact that a lot of the player base for this come from kind of Age of Sigmar, 40K fantasy as well, I think people just, a lot of people just like to play aggro. It's just what they want to play.
True.
I think you're going to see in a lot of tournaments that just the majority of people run aggro.
Mm. And I guess that sort of is, I think, fairly true. At least that's what we've seen at the tournaments we've been to. Is that, do you think that's been fairly true for the tournaments you've been to?
Oh, absolutely. It's there was a very short period in season one where I think I saw a lot of Sepulchral Guard and Spikeclaw Swarm objective decks. Mm-hmm. But then Great Concussion came out. but yeah. even after Great Concussion got banned, I think people have kind of been reluctant to go onto them a bit. Don't get me wrong; they're not like this tiny little minority of the game that no one's heard of. You know, you see a lot of, you know, hold objective decks, and you see the occasional defensive deck, but aggro is definitely the mainstay. You see them the most.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
So we covered often, as is the case, when we're talking about what restricted cards you would use, people are looking pretty quickly at the objective cards. So kind of mentioned some objective cards, mentioned Ready for Action. Are there any restricted cards that we didn't mention yet that they kind of spring to mind?
Yeah, definitely. Deathly Fortitude and Sudden Growth are really possible.
Yeah.
If you're one fighter that's in a position they can hit at suddenly goes to 8 wounds, it makes their game pretty difficult. One of the worst is if they Hidden Paths in and then you play Deathly Fortitude on the fighter that they're next to. It does depend on exactly which one you're trying to build as well, but yeah, no, those two upgrades are absolutely solid. And if you don't have to take upgrades, if you don't have to take objectives that use the restricted slots, get them.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, there were two others as well. A Destiny to Meet and a Slumbering Key are always really tempting. Mm-hmm. They're just free glory at the end of the game for existing, which is like your whole purpose of your deck.
Right.
Another good one if you've got a free slot for them.
How do you feel about my turn?
In a super pure defensive deck, I don't like it. But if you're even slightly flexing to the idea of killing people, then it's pretty good. If you like include stuff like Great Strength or anything that means you can one hit kill a four wound fighter, then my turn's really good because you can usually survive the hit, especially if you've got the plus wound cards, and it gives you a free chance at killing them back.
That was my thoughts with Malog, at least.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's, we're talking about the control style where if they've had to spend a lot of their maybe relatively scarce resources on getting all the way across to where you are, maybe they're only getting there with one or two. And if you can deal with that one or two fighters that get there, then that kind of puts the nail in the coffin for it. So I think that's maybe where that comes in, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, so talking further on deck construction, David was wondering, you know, do you basically think that there's this suite of generic cards, and then you just pick the most survivable warband, was his question. And you may have touched on this a little earlier where you're talking about the reason Cursebreakers and Steelhearts are better options is because some of their in-faction cards, and you may not be salting in a bunch of them, but even just that, I don't know, 15 to 20% of your deck that you're using their stuff for is enough to kind of tip it over. Would you agree with that? That is sort of a, that's what makes a good control, a defensive warband what it is that little salting in on top of just their fighters.
Oh, absolutely. Like any other game, like every single edge you can take makes a lot of difference. With Steelhearts, your two big in-faction cards that are kind of your staples and make you good for defense are Peal of Thunder, which is your kind of faction-specific distraction, and Consecrated Area, which is one glory objective at the end of turn. if there's no enemy fighters adjacent to your fighters, and it's basically a free one glory at the end of the turn for you.
Yeah, it's remarkably easy to score. I remember when we first started playing the game, I was like, oh man, how would that ever happen? Because I was just thinking of like running right back at the Reavers and just getting in a punch out. But I found it very easy to score every time it's come up. So
I'd be tempted to take in an aggressive Steelheart stat, because even if you're going in and fighting people, like usually the people you're fighting are dead next to you, or you just push each other back.
Exactly. Yep. And that was, I guess that was a good example of early assumptions not carrying through. I think we talked about in our first episode where when I first started playing, looking at sidestep, I'm like, one hex, who cares? You know, throw that away. And now it's, you know, one of my favorite cards, right? Sidestep.
I think we all did that early on.
Yeah. All right. Do you have anything else you want to talk about for deck construction here that we haven't covered?
Not necessarily particularly, no. I think when it comes to defensive decks, you have your own set of challenges. And the best thing you can do, it's the same with anything, but the best thing you can do is just get lots of reps against your opponent, see what's working, and then adjust. So start with something that you think is good, and then as you realize it's bad, change the bits.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Little All scientific right. method here.
Yeah, yeah. Totally. Let's hop on, and this is a topic that's a little bit difficult to do in a purely audio medium, but boards. What considerations do you put towards boards? And in part of that, answering that, what specifically Rowan wanted to know, what boards do you pick or at least consider when you lose the roll, so you're placing first?
Okay, so with a defensive deck, generally, there's one board you always pick. So again, in this case, I'm talking about if you're playing Steelheart or Cursebreakers. So I'm assuming you've only got three fighters that you have to get out. I would always pick, I'm going to pronounce this horribly, Sishian Stardial.
Good enough, yeah.
Is that the one with the three black hexes right next to each other?
Yeah, yes, it's that one.
Yeah. That would sort of be my go-to one as well.
So basically, if your opponent, especially if you're in a best of three and it's games two or three, they know what you're doing. They're always going to want to play wide because it's the quickest way to get at you. Mm-hmm. And no matter which way they rotate this board, you've got three fighters at the back, two at the very back, and then only one hex forwards. Mm-hmm. If they decide to offset or longboard you, that's great because you're happy with that as well.
Sure, even better. And either way, having those three blocked together will help delay or slow down anybody coming in often.
Yeah, absolutely.
And mess up people with ranged attacks too. It causes problems for line of sight.
Yeah, line of sight is, until you get used to it, surprisingly a little bit weird in Warhammer Underworlds, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I remember when we kind of figured out that, oh wait, fighters are not blocking line of sight. That was kind of an early on. it's not intuitive, right? You know, like this hex that is covering like half of the path from me to there is blocking it, but not the huge Oberyn standing in between.
So, oh, yeah. Moloch doesn't block out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know the name of this one. Do you give any consideration to the, I was calling it the lava pit. I see, John Reese calling it the Amber Catacomb. I don't know if he's got inside info or if he just decided to name it himself, but, That newest board that has the three lethal all stacked together.
I think it can be good if you're doing some sort of weird strategy where you're trying to sacrifice stuff to lethal hexes. I only say this because I've seen it discussed by crazy Eyes of the Nine players.
Yeah, that's some fun.
Yeah, you've seen those discussions. Yeah, if you get to control board, that board is absolutely the best board in the game. So if you're in position, so it's not a reaction board, you get to place them, that board is insane. Not necessarily for defensive decks, but it's insanely powerful in general. But as a reaction, I don't really like it. I think it's a bit too easily exploitable by your opponent. Mm-hmm. They just put it in a position where the three lethal hexes aren't near you.
Sure.
The only time, I take it as a defensive reaction board is if I was doing something where I really needed to suicide stuff to those lethal hexes.
Mm-hmm. So we're saying if you lose a roll off, you're probably going Shaishin Stardial. If you win, are you going with this Amber Catacomb, or is there?
So I probably wouldn't go with the Amber Catacomb even if I win, despite what I just said. Mm-hmm. So defensive decks generally don't kill people. if you're doing the Cursebreaker thing where you're doing all the damage, maybe you play this, and maybe you orientate it in an offset way, so they're kind of having to either skirt around the lethal board or take that bit of damage that might end up being making them easier to kill. But for Steelhearts and that weird other kind of full magic Cursebreaker deck I was talking about, I wouldn't go with this one. You're more concerned about forcing them to travel as far as possible. And if they take damage on the way, it doesn't make a difference to you because you're generally not killing them anyway.
Right.
So that covers boards. We got anything else? The other sort of aspect of boards is, what are you doing with the objective tokens when they come out? So you're playing defensively. You've either won or lost. What's in your mind about when that step comes in? Go ahead.
So just first, I just want to say what I would use for a defensive
board
if I got to place them. My go-to is the Animus Forge. If you place that, you know, have you got a picture of it up on your screens at all?
Yep.
So if you place that in a kind of orientation where those two block texts are towards the top left, and you offset boards with your opponent, and then they have to travel quite a long way through this kind of little choke point to try and get to you, which is really nasty for them. That's my go-to. If they have picked a board where they've got kind of starting hexes right in the corners that you can't kind of easily abuse with that, then my other one is, the Shattered Tower. And I do the Shattered Tower and Longboard.
Okay.
With that kind of trio of hexes at the back.
Yeah. These are the three hexes with the one split off from the two.
That one, yeah. Yep. And you use them as those kind of blocked hexes, just making more distance between you and them, and you kind of hide at the back in that kind of right-hand side.
All right. Those are all super strong. I don't know where to drop this in. One card I've been thinking about, I wonder if it would fit in with these, is the Shardfall. Like, not Shardgale, but the Shardfall, where you drop a block, especially in combination with these boards that already have a lot of block hexes. Have you done any experimentation with that card, or is that?
I have. It's really good. No, it's really good. One thing as well that a lot of people don't think about with it is, if you start with it in hand and you're against an objective deck, then in your first power step, you put it on an objective token in their territory, and you watch them cry.
I think it's one of those that's a deceptively large number of uses for it, right? Like, there's some pretty cool things. I know Joe Sloboda is a huge proponent of that card. I think he says the only card he includes in every deck, which might be a little bit overstating its utility, but he believes, and that's good enough for me.
I personally, for my test, I couldn't quite fit it in. I didn't quite find it good enough, but it's one of those that, because there's so many different ways to use it, it's got quite a high skill ceiling. It might have just been that I didn't give it enough time, but undoubtedly it's good. There's no question it's good.
Sure. It'd be interesting to see I think it's one of those edge, it's your 11th or 12th ploy, right? Your 11th or 12th gambit, and so it ends up getting cut. I wonder, you know, with Nighthaunt being able to move through hexes, I wonder if the Warband that's coming out in Dreadfane, the Banshees that have the smaller model count and higher wounds, and then they can drop it and then be able to move through it themselves. I wonder if they'll be able to leverage it. Anyway, that's a little tangent there, but back to objective tokens. When you're dropping those, what's in your mind when you're playing this control playstyle?
So if I'm pretty confident that my opponent doesn't care about objective tokens themselves, I'm usually treating objective tokens just as Faneway portals, ways that my opponent can get to me, or ways that I can escape from my opponent once they get too close to me. So I try to push them towards my opponent's board. If I can, and this bit's more tricky, I try and make the ones that I put on my board not kind of blocking the areas where they would like to put them, like more like to put them. So you can kind of block them from going within two of each other. That's a bit of a dangerous game, though, and it did also cost me a game. I think it pretty much cost me a tournament. I was playing I was playing Reavers at a tournament, and my opponent was on McGore's Fiends. And in game two, he surprised me with Supremacy, I did not see that coming. So sometimes you shouldn't necessarily be super confident that your opponent is definitely doing what you think they're doing.
I love that.
Yeah, I almost feel like there's a whole episode in sort of dark horse deck construction where you've got surprises and such. But yeah, I agree. So a lot of people are treating it purely as like a subway tunnel to get where they're going. So think about it in those terms. So you push them. All right. Well, let's talk about actually playing with it. So play and counterplay, we're going to kind of combine a little bit here. I think they naturally flow together a little bit. There was one listener, Christopher, who was asking about playing defensively versus hidden paths. And it's already kind of came up in passing. You've got a low model warband. He's asking, do you still position on edge hexes, or do you try to stay away to protect yourself from that? What's your strategy? And I think this also applies to any of the, you know, sudden appearance is a real pain. Faneway Crystal, some of these teleportation cards that will drop in and have a good chance to disrupt your strategy to a lesser extent, maybe Spectral Wings, where they'll plunge in. Those are the cards I think that you're on high alert for, that you're watching, because these are the ones that have the potential to really disrupt your game plan, right? Do you have a general strategy in how you deal with those, and possibly specifically hidden paths?
So yeah, absolutely. Honestly, I'm quite glad that these cards exist, mm-hmm. because it means that the cards are so good that pretty much everyone runs them. And it means that we don't get what used to happen, which we touched on earlier, where players will come to a tournament with their generic good deck, face a defensive deck, and have nothing they can do. Mm-hmm. They've always got hidden paths or Faneway Crystal these days. They've always got at least some way of getting to you. So I'm actually happy they exist, even though they make the job harder. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, it's not worth trying to run away from edge hexes, because with a defensive deck, it sounds mad, but you're actually happy to spend all your activation drawing cards. Mm-hmm. Your cards are really powerful. That's how your deck works. And if you just spend three activations moving, you don't necessarily have the tool you need. And also, you could be moving closer to them, so they could just normally move up. You know, if you're too afraid of hidden path, they'll just walk across the board to you.
Mm-hmm.
My best tools for dealing with hidden paths are making sure I kind of position away so you don't want them to be able to hidden path in between two of your models.
Yes,
that's the absolute nightmare scenario, because if they do that, they're going to attack someone. You won't have enough cards in your hand to be able to deal with two. But if they can only come against one, then just use a push like distraction.
Mm-hmm.
Use your own hidden paths. If you've got Force or Denial in your hand, which I absolutely love as a defensive player, then just you've got 50-50 to stop them even casting it in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
There's a few decent tools. I mean, also, if you've got Glory in hand, ready for action, just hit them.
Yeah.
Even if you don't kill them, push them away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or use the move to move away.
Right. I either way. And I think what you've hit on there is crucial. Like, this control playstyle is about having a lot of power cards in hand.
Mm.
And so then when the crucial points come in, you know, pop up in the game, you have more resources to throw at that problem than your opponent does, because they've been forced to spend resources to get to you or to, you know, try to move that way. And theoretically, they're somewhat starved of resources because of your denial option.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'll probably mention it later if we talk about good ways to beat them. But yeah, if your opponent knows what you're doing, then you definitely can be sweating, and you need all your tricks in your hand to kind of to ride it out towards the end.
Mm-hmm. And I think you have to be patient with them, right? Like you might see, oh, I could use my distraction here or Peal of Thunder. I could get some incremental advantage, but it may be more important to hold on to it for that real crucial moment. I think that's probably where some of the skill cap comes in, is figuring out when is the moment that you need to start spending these resources. What are the real breaking points for you?
Yeah, no, and also you get into the weird thing of, so with Warhammer Underworlds, we have this incredibly powerful mechanic of, you know, any cards that you get rid of at the end of each turn, you draw back up to five.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're spending four activations drawing cards, then you could have six or seven in your hand. Do you discard down so you draw three cards, or do you keep a hand of six or seven?
Yeah.
And that's there's not always an easy answer to that. That's not always obvious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in sure. my reps playing with your, specifically your Steelhearts deck, that was what I was finding is I'd get to the end, I'd drawn a bunch of cards and Duel of Wits, and so I had a real fat hand, and then I'd use some of them late to, you know, jump over and kill somebody or escape, but I was still sitting on that six or seven, and having no prior practice with it, that was, I felt like that was maybe the hardest, well, it was certainly one of the harder portions of it was trying to figure out, you know, what, I can probably identify a couple cards in this hand that I don't think are going to pop up, but I can't identify enough to, you know, get myself all the way down to the free draw.
So. Yeah, no, absolutely. It comes down to experience at that point. It's like realizing what are the super powerful ploys that you always want to keep in your hand, and what are the, this is only really that useful in that situation, so it's fine to throw it, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. You have, let's see, do you have any tips for people? So Christopher specifically was asking what the definition of Turtle Cast was and how you play against Turtle Cast. And I think Turtle Cast probably, well, I'll let you define it, but I think it's I think it's a little bit of a legacy term at this point, maybe.
It's literally just another way of describing defensive or control decks. It's, I mean, technically it explicitly refers to Stormcast Eternals, but that's what's played as defensive or control deck nowadays. I think the way to beat it is, I don't know if you've obviously a massive publicizing myself here, but I don't know if you've read Tom's articles on the blog at all.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
He wrote some how to beat defensive decks. They're a bit old now because they were written, what, 6-7 months ago? But gist of them still the same. Pack mobility cards, so pack Hidden Path, pack Spectral Rings. Pack some passive glory that you could score in your deck if you're not killing things. So Alone in the Darkness or some weird stuff like Rivers of Blood and Shard Gale, something like that. Something that means you can actually use upgrades. And then one of the more tricky ones is judge how many activations you can waste drawing cards versus moving across the board. Because you're in this game where you know you've got these tools like Hidden Paths and Spectral Wings, which will get you to your opponent and make their life horrible. So you're wanting to get to them. But if you don't just move across the board and threaten your opponent normally, then they're probably going to beat you in that game of cards. You kind of need to play both the game of cards and the board, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And hold your nerve, because you've got to be, it's horrible, because you're going to have a very rough first turn, maybe a very rough second turn. But if you just kill one, then suddenly you'll get a bunch of glory and you can just combo it into killing the rest of them and you've won.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. I think it's interesting because a lot of the advice, I think, generally applies to the game as a whole. For anyone who's playing aggro, because it's kind of like, your dice aren't always going to be there for you. You need to have other tools in your toolbox, which I think may be part of why people get kind of salty about dice sometimes. Because it's like, this had to work.
And right, they didn't build any backup, man.
I mean, to be honest, we all get salty over dice. Well, let's be fair.
Unless you're Aaron, and then you just don't roll dice.
But yeah, no, I mean, it is very frustrating if you get into this one position, especially against a defensive deck. If you manage to get this position where it's going to be pretty much your one attack of the game, you stack it with, say, a Potion of Rage or a Haymaker, and you know you've got like three score immediately objectives you'll get off this, and then you can use that to get escalated. You know, it's going to be some ridiculous thing, and then they roll the crit defense.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that yep. sucks.
Or last chance.
Yeah.
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 Although generally you don't win last chance for shield warbands, generally, I say.
Sure.
Because it's not actually necessarily the worst idea. It's still a 50-50.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in our last game, Phil kept dropping that on Kacharik because he was the guy who was killing. That was very important. So, and even on the other side, when that card drops, like, ugh, I don't like a 50-50 for that guy to still be alive. That's not great. But
yeah,
some more play, and this time play rather than counterplay. Tony Field, who has an excellent interview on Path to Glory. By the time this drops, that'll be a little bit old, but he did some interesting things. Did had a good showing at Adepticon, and then took a really rogue deck that was based around all or nothing, if you with Eyes of the Nine. So if you want to check that out, go check out Path to Glory's second episode. But he's asking, how does a defensive strategy deal with Molog and Tome of Offerings? Do you feel like that's one of the more challenging matchups as it stands?
It cries. so yes, that is a more challenging matchup. The challenge is, so right, your whole deck is brought around hiding at the back and kind of out getting more glory than your opponent and kind of delaying them getting to you. Molog can move 6 hexes in one turn and has an attack range of 2. He only needs to be inspired to do 4 damage and one shot any of your fighters.
Mm-hmm.
there's not really any hiding from him. There are some tricks you can do. There is a game you can play against him, but it puts a lot of pressure on you, and I wouldn't say you're favored against it.
Mm-hmm.
If you have stuff like, but generally the best thing you can do is, if you've got stuff like Transfixing Stare, delay him for a turn, or wait for him to come all the way across, sacrifice one of your guys, realize they're going to die, and then get the other two across with like Hidden Path and Faneway,
yes,
and just run all the way back and leave him sitting there confused.
Mm-hmm.
And that's your best bet.
mulch cave squigs and such to get.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I mean, even defensive decks can kill squigs. Like yeah. they're two health. You know.
Yeah.
Right.
And the danger comes if you're playing against a really good Molog deck. I'm saying this because I played a Molog deck and I included this card. So this is what I consider good.
Mm-hmm.
Although. There's a reason people don't run it, because it's restricted. But if he packs Illusory Fighter, then that's it. It's GG. I don't know why more Molochs don't run Illusory Fighter. I think it's absolutely insane. I know why. It's restricted, and restricted slots are really hard to come by. But
sure.
It puts you on any starting hex in your territory without putting a token on you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nuts. And with his reach and mobility, that's banana town. With I tell you, and not to be a one note song about this, but I, again, playing the Steelhearts deck you put together, that might have been my happiest moment, was drawing a power card hand and seeing my old friend Illusory Fighter in there. I was like, oh, I've missed you so much. You're so good. I just love how many different things you can do with it. And as I've mentioned before, any card that lets me try a bunch of things and feel really clever for doing what maybe wasn't actually all that clever, but makes me feel good about myself. And I'm a big fan of that card. So.
Yeah. I think Illusory Fighter's inclusion on the first bar list was actually a really good sign that Games Workshop do testing and do know the game, because no one was really complaining about the card before, and it was only being run in a couple of handful of decks, but it was really good, and it's still really good, even though it's restricted. So it was absolutely right to put it on that list. So
definitely. Yeah. And I think I mentioned one of the things I was most entertained by / impressed by watching the Adepticon final was Aman was using Cursebreaker with Commanding Stride, and he was effectively using it as Illusory Fighter, like an Illusory Fighter light, and it seemed really effective. And you're talking about a card that it's only going 3 hexes and it's only on your leader, but he would use it the defensive way, where he'd charge out, make an attack, and then use it to pull Cursebreaker right back out of danger, or use it to extend his threat range. And I was like, yeah, this is all that stuff that Illusory Fighter is great at doing. So.
Yeah, no. Commanding Stride is another. I think the more you play the game, the more you start realizing that these kind of mobility cards are so powerful.
Mm-hmm. Right, and
the
so
first episode.
Yeah. Then advice to folks who are looking: how would I counter defensive play? Include these mobility cards, and then once you've included them, you probably are going to realize that they may have even made your deck stronger than what it was when you were simply stacking accuracy and damage buffs on your fighters.
Right.
So,
yeah, because being able to pick who fights what is incredible, even in an aggro mirror. Like, if you're playing Fiends and you force your opponent to only be able to attack the Dangoros, like Gartok, and I can't pronounce his name, the guy who begins with a Z, those two guys, then it's great, because then Magor and Riptooth will just finish everything off.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think so. We've come to the end of our listener questions. We have any other thoughts that we want to cover on the idea of defensive play here?
I think it's really worth, like I said, bearing in mind how this, even if you don't play it, how this style works. Because the worst thing is if you're prepping for like a Grand Clash, it's not so bad at a normal tournament, or it's still not ideal, but if you're prepping for a Grand Clash, you know, you spend quite a bit of time, you go there and someone does this, longboards you with steel hearts, and you literally have no idea what's going on. Mm-hmm. I understand why people call them non-interactive and stuff like that when that situation happens, because it just feels like, why did I show up? Mm-hmm. But if you know they exist and you know how they tick, then you kind of actually can have really interesting games around them. And like, yeah. Honestly, the best, like the most fun I've had playing it are when my opponent's in the know, mm-hmm. and we're doing this of crazy mind games, power card stuff.
Yeah,
and like this cat and mouse game across, that's fun. I love it.
Yeah, I can remember Aaron bringing the Cataphrain Relics Steel Hearts, and he'd never played it before, but we both read about it a fair amount. I'd read about it a ton, and I was curious at the time. I was using these Far Striders, and I was trying to figure out like if somebody brings these, could I beat them? And so it wasn't the best test, since didn't have a lot of reps with them. Conversely, I didn't have a lot of reps against him, but it was exactly that kind of game where I knew what in general he was trying to do, and it was just a matter of identifying what crucial resources I had in my deck that I needed to get to find, and how important it was to spend time getting those versus when did I have enough to try to make my play to counter it. And absolutely right, it was just that fun sort of mental chess game of us going, you know, I know what you're doing and you know I know what you're doing, but now can we, you know, where are we going to go with that? So
yeah, no, it's really fun. I think if you take it as a learning experience, if you lose to them and you kind of adjust to them, I don't think many people actually dislike them nowadays. I think the kind of general sentiment against them started waning since the relics have gone. Mm-hmm. Fair play. The relics were in their, you know, original state. They were ridiculous. It wasn't a fun mm-hmm. thing to play against, and it was a bit silly. Although, on that note,
yes,
they have started creeping up again, haven't they?
Yeah. There
have been people using them.
With ghosts, I think, mostly. Which is I haven't seen it played, but I would guess they're playing fairly defensively. I know it's a lot of just using Varklav.
I actually played against a Relic Ghost deck at the January Warhammer World Grand Clash, the big one with 168 players.
Yeah, sure.
It was Jamie Giblin was on them.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. I beat him, but I was exceptionally lucky.
Okay.
So I was playing Ghosts myself. I was playing a kind of a mix between objective and aggro, because you can just use the Queen to kill things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Bryce had finished. So it was, I think, games one and two were... games one and three were completely reasonable. We outplayed each other. We both won. It was game two that was ridiculous. Bryce had come over to watch a guy who ended up winning the tournament in the end, because mm-hmm. he'd finished his games early. And game two, he hadn't played Ghoulish Pact yet. It was the only thing stopping him from getting to six relics. It was on turn three, I think, already.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd won the roll off for who went first, and he picked me to go first so he could have the reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in my activation. I was like, if he plays Ghoulish Pact, I've just lost. He'll just play Ghoulish Pact and start pressing the I win button.
Mm-hmm.
I had Forceful Denial in my deck, and I had six cards in my deck.
No,
I drew Forceful Denial. He played Ghoulish Pact, and I won the 50-50. So I completely outplayed it. but yeah, no, they exist. They're good, but they're not ridiculous. If you know what you're doing against them, you can beat them. Mm-hmm. It's worth keeping your eye on, though. I've seen some Gits people do them.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, because you can, you know, the Fanatic. He's got the extra action, so he can draw the cards.
Yep.
And you could do these weird things where you build a wall with squigs so people can't get to you.
Oh.
Yeah, you just surround Snurk with so many ablative wounds they can't even kill him.
And in that crucial period where you're trying to take actions to draw further cards to get the rest of your relics, he is a fighter who can attack, or who can activate over and over again, right? I mean, yeah, I haven't seen absolutely. It, but I'm assuming this is part of the strength of it, is that he can help you cycle and get through the cards to see what you need to see once he's got the four relics, right?
Yep, and once you get two on him, his three dodge dice can all be rerolled.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's a... Oh yeah, all right. Some wheels turning.
Yeah. Time to convert a Snurk in full armor and Cataphrine relic gear.
Yeah, sorry, I've just gone off on tangents and started talking about random stuff. I can't remember what the original question was.
I think we were just seeing if we had anything left to talk about. You did mention Jamie Giblin, and that reminds me, I did actually miss one listener question, and it is from Jamie Giblin, and he says, "Are you Michael Carlin?" Because I had mentioned a mystery guest, so I think he was just showing he knew it was up. So.
Yes, it's me. Yeah. The one and only Michael Carlin. I look forward to facing him on Saturday at another tournament.
Ah, excellent. I hope we get to read about it one way or the other. So,
I'm in this awkward stage where I'm trying to keep what I'm doing secret. Yeah.
Well, just because I don't read about it right after it happens doesn't mean I won't read about it eventually. I'm looking forward to seeing some of these decks once they're available to be revealed a little bit. So.
One thing I'm trying to do, what I did with the Steelhearts article, where every single version of the deck I'm saving. Mm. So I could do my final article, and this is how I built them. Whether or not I do well at the Grand Clash, I'm just going to do this was my plan. This is what happened. Mm. And I can kind of show the organic / realizing what I built was bad evolution of the deck.
and that, again, I already said it, but that was an excellent read, excellent format. Our last couple episodes, which you actually haven't heard yet at this point because they're about to come out the next few. We used that. We basically tried to do that idea, that format justice with our own stuff that we brought to Adepticon. So we'll be covering. Okay. We'll be on.
I look forward to listening to them.
All right. Well, they'll be coming out. I think that about covers it. Does anybody else have anything they want to bring up?
No, I think I'm good.
All right.
Just one last thing. I'll just say, sorry, I've not been good at releasing articles recently. I'm rubbish. I'm working a little bit more than I used to. Mm-hmm. But no, mostly it's just I'm being rubbish. I shouldn't make excuses. I need to get stuff out.
I was just figuring it was a quality over quantity sort of thing.
Yes. Yeah, there we go. That was it.
Saved
it.
Yeah. Well, all right. We'll do a quick pause here. You got anything you want to recommend, or should I just lay it out for the music?
I'm not exactly sure. What do you mean? Just recommend a random song for people to listen to? Or?
Oh, I do. I just I often do it as it's themed somehow. So like a defensive a song, whatever. It's like a cute thing I do where it might have defense and there were control in the title or something like that.
Oh, no, I'm fine. Whatever you think's best. No, absolutely fine.
Fair enough. All right. Well, Michael, it has been an absolute treat to have you on. You've been awesome. I think I would love to find another excuse to get you on here at a later date. So if there is a topic that you feel that you'd like to talk about above and beyond your blog or in supplement to that, let us know. And if we think of something, we'll grab you. But you're welcome on anytime. So.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. It's been really enjoyable.
As always, if you get a chance, drop us a review. It helps us out. You can get in touch with us at WTHcast and whatthehexcast@gmail.com. Michael, if folks wanted to get in touch with you, there's obviously your blog, steelcityunderworlds.com. And how else would they be able to get in touch with you?
So you can chat to me on the Discord, if you know what the Discord is. Or we do have an email address, and I definitely have it in front of me now to tell you because I'm prepared. here we go. team@steelcityshadespire.com.
Excellent. And that is it. If you want to get more of the Mortal Realms content, there's obviously www.themortalrealms.com. We are far enough in the future at this point that we'll keep it close, keep it secret, keep it safe as far as what our next episode is, which is code for I don't know. So we'll pick a topic. You recommend listening for this episode is Universal Mind Control by Common off of the off the album by the same title. And that's it for What the Hex? I've been Davey.
This is Phil.
And I've been Michael Carlin. and looking forward to listening to those podcasts you got lined up.
Yeah. That's the one strange thing about how we do these. We record them a little bit in advance, so this one won't be dropping for about 4 weeks' time. So people will be really just on the edge of their seats. Actually, at that point, maybe the new war bands will drop, but nobody will care. Whoops.
I think I saw that they're going on pre-order this next week.
Oh, my gosh. All right. Spicy. That sounds good.
Instead of directly plugging the microphone in, I plug it into the board first, and then I can control levels and stuff. Like, if I wanted to, I could, like, change my low, and I probably sound really different now.
Yeah. Wow. You just relentlessly play with all those settings throughout this and give me an editing nightmare. That sounds really fun.
No, it seems all good. Completely understandable. If you've got kids, it's can be a bit tricky to do stuff like this sometimes.
Oh, man, it's a bit tricky to even play sometimes. So. I'm quite jealous of all these other folks who are blogging. I don't know how many of them actually have kids, but they're like, yeah, I went to like 3 tournaments this weekend. I'm like, what?
I didn't leave my house this weekend.
Anyone who can't beat a defensive deck's rubbish.